Now, reading texts, those of you who do arts degrees touch on this. If you haven't done an arts degree, it's quite funny the way they now talk in arts, where a text is not just literally a text, you know, but we can call a movie a text. Did you know that? We could even call being in this room a text of sorts that we could study. It's ridiculous. But reading texts is a slippery business. We all bring our own interpretations and baggage to the text. We all, in a sense, try and master the text and use it for our own ends. Yeah? Some of us create texts and mold them our own way. Some of them twist them and distort them. Some of them try and submit to them and be shaped by them. So that leads many people, and many people say in the humanities faculty here, to say you can't actually know what a text says. You can't know what it actually says. In fact, to talk about what a text actually says is sort of a little bit silly, childish, old-fashioned. Actually says? Really? Goodness me. You see, what a lot of people would want to say, as far as the reader is concerned, as far as you or I opening John's Gospel is concerned, that the author is dead. His or her interpretation is lost. It's inaccessible, yeah? So we all just need to bring whatever games we want to play to the text. And so people could say of John's Gospel that we just read it for our own games, our own agenda, the benefits that we want to bring to it, or the benefits that we want to then use it to impose upon others. It's our reading of the text that we then engage in. But there are others, and I'm one of them, and I think a Christian ought to be one of them, who believe that you can get at the truth and meaning of texts. You can get to know the author. Not fully, not perfectly, not completely, not totally, but you can get to know the author through the text he's presented. People like this, and like myself, and I think like Christians ought to be, are people who want to say there is actually not just the audience John wrote to and the purpose that John had, but also, I discovered this the other day, that there's a term that people use called the implied reader. The implied reader is the imaginary reader who completely gets what the author is saying. So he's writing to an audience who may understand him to some degree or another, but his goal is for his audience to eventually reach an understanding of the implied reader, who totally gets the in-jokes, the connections, the ideas, the concepts. Do you know what I mean? Someone who fully grasps. A little bit like someone who's read John again and again and again and gotten better and better familiar with John and more grasp of how it all hangs together. And so they're not only his audience, but they're increasingly the kind of dream reader, you know, who totally gets it. I want to say that we should strive to become the implied reader, and that we should strive to understand the author as best we can, understand his original audience as the kind of, if you like, the moral owners of the text, and get to know what that author was saying to that audience so that we can gradually grasp what the author is saying. I mean, even postmodernists and relativists hold to this to some extent. You know, if a lecturer says something and then you come up to him afterwards and say, "I love the way you said the opposite," he'll get a little irritated, won't he? "That's not what I said," he'll say. And you'll go, "Oh, I love the fact that you're agreeing with me." "I'm not agreeing with you. I'm saying you misunderstood my lecture." "Beautiful point. Yes, we're right on this, aren't we?" He'd start to get pretty worked up, wouldn't he? Because in practice, we do want people to understand what we're saying. You know, even last year there was a fiasco with a postmodern artistic playwright who got angry that a theatre company misappropriated his work. Now, I don't know whether they get the irony of that. In practice, we do care about what other people think. Even post-Christian, post-modern, post-everythings get antsy when they're misquoted. It's not easy to fully grasp a text. It's not easy to become the ideal reader. It's not easy to fully grasp the point of view of the author. It's never complete, but it is possible. Partially, imperfectly, subjectively, but possible. And one of the great ways to do this, the careful tool to help us to be patiently attentive to a text, is to pay attention to its context. Yeah? It's the text without its context that's the pretext for the proof text. But when you put the text in its context, then actually you're guarded against that proof text. As you get to know the author better, as you, in a sense, read it and then read it again, the sustained usage of similar situations give you a sense of what the speaker wants to mean. And so what we're going to do today is grasp the symbolism at work here in John chapter 2 and see its usage throughout John's writing and John's gospel to fully grasp the significance of this event he's recording, this wedding at Cana. Some people say, oh, this is a retelling of Dionysian mythology, or, oh, this is a description of the wedding of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Rather than get carried away, let's pay attention to the clues in the text itself. For there are symbols here woven through, five symbols that we're just going to touch on very briefly in our time together this morning. Number one, the mention of the third day. See that in 2 verse 1? On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Now, this could be neither here nor there. It's simply a historical reference, except for the fact that John is explicitly counting days for us at quite some length. You see it back in verse 29, where we have reference to the next day. And then again, we see it in verse 29, then again verse 35, we have another reference to the next day. And then verse 43, another reference to the next day. And then 2 verse 1, on the third day. It's a structural marker that he's telling the story. Other gospels sometimes just say, then this, immediately that, after this, then. You know, there's other ways of marking time. But to so explicitly list, and the number draws is a thing that at least piques our curiosity. And goes, oh, I wonder what's going on there. You know, if you watch an action movie and you don't realise what the action movie is, you come in just as the credits are rolling and you see like a little toy boat going down the gutter and then sort of start to get stuck just at the storm drain and then go in. You know, an astute watcher of action movies will go, now I wonder why I did that. Bet your boat's going to start getting sunk. Bet you there's a flood coming. But, you know, you're going to start thinking, aren't you? Opening scene of an action movie and there's a kid in his room playing with a little dinosaur going, rah! An astute watcher of every single action movie will go, okay, monster movie. You begin to pick those things up, don't you? So here we've got this third day, this first, well, if it's not quite a symbol, in the first place it's a historical marker, but it comes to function as something which carries more meaning still. First of all, it's a time marker, but in the text it begins to function as something more. Yes, when we read this text from beginning to end, we find the text is talking about history, it's talking about places, it's talking about geography, it's talking about titles and figures and contexts and cultural habits and all these sorts of things. But at the same time, as we read John's Gospel more, we realise as he tells his history, he's telling it as a theological history. Yeah, he's telling it as a history and its interpretation. So this event in history that happened 3 days after the encounter with Nathanael that we read about in 1 verse 43 and following, this event that happened in Cana in Galilee, somewhere between 27 and 30 AD, possibly also has some symbolic significance. First of these is third day. We find third day mentioned again in the second story in chapter 2, verse 19. Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days. This pattern of the third day being a time of restoration is a numerical echo or evocation or theme. You know, it's on the third day that Abraham arrives at the place of sacrifice where his son Isaac is figuratively returned from the dead. It's on the third day that God descends upon Sinai and meets with Israel and gives the law and makes a nation, calls it into being. It's on the third day that Esther comes and intercedes for the Jews. So third day could be just a little echo of that kind of theme. You know, as we read the whole gospel and see the rising from the dead on the third day and then come back to the beginning, we may go, ah, all right, so here's this event that is one all about celebration, wedding, feasting. More of that in a second. If that happens on the third day, it could evoke those things. And so perhaps we are to read this episode of Water to Wine in this light as a story of renewal and rescue. That's possible. You know, we're trying to draw close to the author here, and this one we can't be too confident on. More clear, however, is that this third day, as a part of this longer sequence, is in fact the seventh day. For you see, there's this larger literary scheme that I've just showed you. We begin in 1 verses 19 to 28 with the people coming to John and asking him, who are you? You know, are you Moses? Are you Elijah? All this kind of stuff. 1 verse 19 and following. And then the next day, verse 29, John points out Jesus and says, the Lamb of God. Day 2. And there was morning and there was evening. And then the next day, verse 35, we have disciples hear John point out Jesus and then go to follow him. day three. And then the next day, then morning and evening, verse 39, we have the close of day three. It's about the 10th hour. And so in verse 40, we have another day. We have the day in which Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, gets Simon Peter and brings him to Jesus. Day four. Verse 43, we have the next day. Jesus goes to Galilee and Philip finds Nathanael. Day five. And so to verse one, with an inclusive reckoning of the first day is day one. The second day is skipped. We get to the seventh day. If you want to follow that schema, you can grab me afterwards. This miracle occurs on the final day of a momentous week. Nice, cute, pretty little observation, but there's more to it than that. So this is a seventh-day scheme following a prologue of the whole book. This text begins with a reference to Genesis chapter 1, doesn't it? 1 verse 1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, the Word was with God, the Word was God, He was with God in the beginning. That's evoking Genesis chapter 1 verse 1, to the creation week, morning and evening the first day, morning and evening the second day, morning and evening the third day, morning and evening the fourth day, yeah? That's the context of the book. And to then have a numbering of 7 days, it's just in the next breath. This is far from just language games. This is a seventh-day scheme in a section of John's Gospel full of old and new ideas. Destroy this temple, I'll build a new temple. You must be born again, Nicodemus. The raising of people from the dead. This is an old, new section of John's Gospel that begins with references to the creation week. And then Jesus, in this miracle, as John writes it, his creative power is displayed in turning water into wine. He truly is the one through whom all things were made. Jesus in this miracle, and John in his writing, is anticipating Jesus' new transforming power. The third day. So that's the first symbol. And is that also the second symbol? Yes, because the seventh day, if you like, is the more certain symbol at work. So, third symbol. So look at the third day, which is actually the seventh day, and now look at the six jars. 2 verse 6. So Jesus is at this wedding, they run out of wine, Jesus' mother comes to Jesus, says, I hope no more wine, and Jesus says, dear mother, why do you involve me? Dear woman. Now, it's even blunter than that. There's no dear in the original Greek text. It's just, woman, why do you involve me? Think maybe like a New York taxi driver. Hey, lady, why do you involve me? It's not rude, but neither is it affectionate. It's Jesus saying, you know, this is not my time, yeah? But then he does still go ahead with a miracle. He gives some instructions, and these six stone water jars, verse 6, six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding 20 to 30 gallons, this water is turned into wine. It's helpful for us in understanding the miracle to not just say Jesus turned water to wine, but to say Jesus turned ceremonial washing water to wine. Yeah, it's helpful for us to grasp the significance of the miracle. Jesus took symbolic, ceremonial, ritual water that the Jews would practice ceremonial, symbolic, ritual washings. And having used the water, what would they be? Ceremonially, ritually clean. And then, what did you say, Lauren?
Oh, no, sorry.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, they would remain spiritually dirty and they would remain ultimately still dead under the judgment of God. He takes this external thing, and what does he do? Turns it into, by miraculous life-giving power, turns into a symbol of feasting and celebration and life and new things. Yeah? It's like the healing of the leper that we looked at mid-year conference. Jesus touches the leper, makes him clean, and then says, no, you can go after the priests and they'll do the paperwork. The priests can't make you clean. The priests can just do the paperwork afterwards and say, yes, you're now clean. Yeah? It's a powerful thing. And is there even a hint here that here we've got six on the seventh day, the day of completion and rest and climax? Jesus takes the six, the incomplete, perhaps, the inadequate, the not full to the brim, for they need to be filled to the brim, in verse 7. Jesus takes this incomplete, this not full, this half empty, this ceremonial, this ritual, and turns that water into wine. He takes a symbol of cleansing and transforms it into a symbol of a whole new creation. That same kind of echo is found in John chapter 7. Jesus refers to circumcision there and says, you think circumcision, this symbol of new life, is so important that you'll break the Sabbath for it. This is in John chapter 7, where he says, help me find this one. This just occurred to me off the top of my head. It's not my notes, so I don't have the verse reference. Can you find where he refers to circumcision? Verse 21. Jesus said to them, I did one miracle and you're astonished, yet because Moses gave you circumcision, you circumcise a child on the Sabbath. Circumcision, this symbol, so important you'll break the Sabbath for it. Verse 23 of John 7, if a child is circumcised on the Sabbath, so the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry at me for healing the whole man on the Sabbath? Yeah? Forget stone water jars, forget circumcision, forget the temple in the second half of John 2. Here is a whole new thing, a whole man being healed, a whole new creation week, a whole new temple being built for out from death. Mere ritual is redundant when God himself is active in the world. Mere ritual is redundant when God himself is active in the world. Mere ritual in this world is redundant when God comes to bring a whole new work. Ceremonial washing is like an endless Friday. I like this line. Ceremonial washing is like an endless Friday compared to Jesus' endless weekend. Like that? I like that. You don't have to like it. I don't mind. I'll still like it. Fourth simple, the new wine. I've already really alluded to the significance of this, haven't I? A miracle alluded to in other histories of Jesus' life is told here. Water into wine, ceremonial water into wine. Verse 7, Jesus said to the servants, fill the gallons with water. So they filled them to the brim, and then he said to them, now draw out some and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from, though the servant who had drawn the water knew, and he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests had too much to drink, but you've saved the best till now. A miracle that is alluded to in the other histories of Jesus' life is told here. Water into wine. Wine is a symbol of celebration. And it comes to stand for celebration. New things. You see it, for example, in Amos.
Done that now? How'd it go?
Good work. There you go. Just Amos 9, that's all. No big deal. Just a Lamentations 4, if that's okay. It is in Amos 8, you did, sorry. And in Amos 9, would have been a bit easier, I reckon. But have a look at how the coming restoration and new life is described. This is just one example of many. In Amos 9, verse 11, in that day I will restore David's fallen tent. Amos 9, verse 11. I'll rebuild its broken places, restore its ruins, and build it as it used to be, so that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that bear my name, declares the Lord, who will do these things. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the ploughman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. There it is. I'll bring back my exiled people, Israel. They'll rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They'll plant vineyards and drink the wine. They'll make gardens and eat the fruit. I'll plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted, for the land I've given them, says the Lord your God. The day, the last day, the coming fulfillment of all God's promises of salvation and new life is the day of drinking and feasting and wine dripping from the hills. Yeah? And that's one of many of those references to the new time to come being the wedding of God with his people, being the great feast where wine drips from the hills. And here comes this one at the end of this new week, takes this ceremonial water and turns it into a symbol of the great wedding of God with his people, of a new coming of God to save his people. Jesus brings the new world into this broken, war-torn, ruining, dust bowl, famine, suffering, Ebola world. And Jesus comes to bring new wine. To bring the new world. And this is his first sign. It's the final symbol we'll touch on. If we had time, we'd also look at this, my time has not yet come, in verse 4, but something has to go. I'm on the cutting room floor, I'm told. So we'll do that. We'll leave that one, my time. The first sign, he says in verse 11, John writes, this is the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. First sign. In fact, the first two are numbered. There's like a little mini section in John, if you like, that begins in Cana, and then kind of comes back to Cana in chapter 4. And so you get a reference to another sign in chapter 4, verse 54. This was the second miraculous sign that Jesus performed coming from Judea to Galilee. This little structure, you know, little mini kind of segment, if you like. You know, if you were Peter Jackson and wanted to turn John's Gospel into 18 films being released every Boxing Day for the next 18 years, then this would be where you'd finish the first one, yeah? This is the second sign numbered there. So partly it's just marking this smaller section of John's Gospel, but also it's the beginning of a larger structural thing. There are very few miracles in John's Gospel. In fact, there are seven. The wine, the chapter 4 healing of the official's son, the healing of the sick man in chapter 5, the walking on water in chapter 6, the feeding of the multitude in chapter 6, the healing of blind man in chapter 9, and the raising of Lazarus in chapter 11. Very few miracles. If you wanted to feed the turn the feeding and the water into one miracle, then Jesus can be the seventh. You take your pick. But just as there are the seven witnesses that we talked about at Citywide, yeah, and the seven I am sayings, I'm the light, I'm the door, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, I'm the resurrection and the life, so there are these seven miracles. The first half of the book of John's Gospel is rightly called the Book of Signs. These signs are these remarkable miracles that testify to who Jesus is, not just as omens or tricks, party tricks, but as things that show who Jesus is. And so, verse 11 of chapter 2, reveal his glory and demand faith. That's what John's doing. He's putting forward a case, saying, here are the evidences, here are the pointers, here are the markers of who Jesus is, how incredible he is, and so he demands your faith in him. That's John's agenda. Right at the very end, he says, in the presence of his witnesses, these signs were performed, and I'm writing them down to persuade you to believe in him, the glorious Son of God, right? And so he wants to provoke faith. If Jesus can turn water into wine, he's the bringer of the new work of God. So, if you want to benefit from the new renewing work of God, who should you trust? Yeah, that's his point. John writes this so that we'll have life in his name by believing he's the Christ. Life, full life, life that's really life. Why should I become a Christian, someone would say? Why bother with this whole church thing, we should say? Because in Jesus you'll have life. Life in his name, life to the full. Wine dripping from the hills, life. Save the best wine till last, life. Yeah? We're saved from the judgment of God, yeah? And that's sometimes we need to talk about that, don't we? The judgment of God to flee. That's part of it. But we're also saved to life as it's meant to be. Life better than it was ever meant to be in Christ. Yeah, both. The pitch, the gospel pitch is both. Flee the wrath to come. Absolutely. And run to the one who gives you the life that's really life. Why become a Christian? To flee the wrath of God to come? Yes. Why become a Christian? John chapter 2. To have the life, that to really live life as it's meant to live. You feel like something's missing. You feel like life isn't all it's meant to be. You feel like that always 6 stone ceremonial jars half full. Well, the real life of God is to be found in the new creation work of God in Jesus. You must be born again. And why keep going as a Christian when all it seems to mean is listening to sermons at ungodly hours of the morning and doing jobs and worrying about people? And constantly having to meet new people and build new relationships and deal with the rejection, the scorn, the frustration. Why keep going as a Christian? Why keep going hard and devout and zealous as a Christian? It hurts. It's painful. It's draining. It's disappointing. It's disillusioning sometimes when it doesn't happen the way you thought it would happen. Well, John chapter 2 encourages us to be reminded that in the gospel we have a new creation. We have a Sabbath in Jesus, a feast in Jesus, something good in him. That I think the longer you go as a Christian, the more you need to learn how to rest in God, don't you? And actually not just find salvation in him, but find a life in him. He's the one who fuels me. In a sense, I enter into that rest in him now. And so I need to keep praying that God give me the joy and the satisfaction of all the good things that Christ is to me. Yeah? And if I start to feel my zeal dry up and my energy lapse and my emotions just feel frayed, then perhaps I need to come back to the giver of life and just spend some time sitting under his... Laura was saying to me the other day that it makes a massive difference when you finally just keep your quiet times there. Everything else, you know, it's almost like we can start to think, oh, I'm too busy to get Bible reading and prayer done. But in the end, of course, we should be saying the opposite. Man, things are too busy and stressful for me not to spend time with God, yeah? That's a shift in the way we need to think, to rest in him, find our joy in him, not just be frantically doing. And of course, the hope, this is the hope to come as well, in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts. Fully, it's the hope when Jesus comes back. So hang in there. Hang in there. It is hard now. Jesus promised it would be hard now. It's not an easy work, the work of the Christian life, but it's worth it. And so when you're finding it hard as a Christian and a Christian active in ministry, you've got to keep realizing heaven will be worth it. Let's pray. Actually, have a pray with the person next to you. Yeah, this is kind of fairly kind of personal application. So maybe just turn to the person next to you and just one of you pray in the pair. I'll pray with you, Paul. How's that sound? Here we go. Oh, come on.